The means of grace are the very thing that evangelicals are looking for.
Chris Roseborough talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And so in my presentation, we will talk about some of the alternative means of grace that evangelicals have created in their quest to find some kind of certainty of their own salvation. But then we will then explore back and look at what God's Word says regarding baptism, the Lord's Supper, as well as holy absolution as the means by which, you know, these are outside of us, that God gives us signs and assurance that we are forgiven and in Him and have a right standing with Him.
You can meet and hear Chris Roseborough making the case for the means of grace June 10th and 11th at the 2016 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Jesus is a good cure for fear. God gives believers the power, the love, the sound mind required to conquer any fear.
The current culture that we're in is that there's an increasing squeeze to try to squeeze physicians who have a conscience out of the practice of medicine.
Be the person God made you to be and fulfill your vocation as you. I mean, you have the same word of the same Lord that Luther had. So be faithful to him.
So our hearts are with Jesus when his word is in our ears, on our minds, and on our tongues.
New dads like listening to Issues Etc.
Well, there are news stories, and then the kind of news stories that just basically wipe everything else off the news. The death of Antonin Scalia, sudden as it was, is one of those. A follow-up to that story, of course, is the fact that he is going to be interned. And when you bury a sitting Supreme Court justice, it's a big deal. How big of a media event is it? And what does journalism need to know walking into the funeral of devout Catholic, Latin Mass Catholic, Antonin Scalia, and his funeral, how they ought to be covering that, and the influence of his religious mind on his legal mind? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live this Wednesday afternoon, February the 17th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about media coverage of Justice Antonin Scalia and his funeral. Terry Mattingly of GetReligion.org will be our guest. Molly Ziegler-Hemingway of The Federalist will join us after that, talking about the feminist outrage over recent motherhood statements made by pop singer Adele. Hadley Arkus joins us for some personal reflections and discussion of the judicial legacy of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. And then Dr. Bill Weinrich will take us into part three of our series on the Gospel of John today, the discourse with Nicodemus. He'll be with us in the last half hour and beyond of Issues Etc. Terry Mattingly is a regular guest. He's senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, and founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to talk to you.
Terry, how big a media event is the death and the funeral of a sitting Supreme Court justice, in this case, Antonin Scalia?
Let me give you two answers on that. The first is, I don't know how big a media event it is in the country, because in large part that depends on how it's covered. I will say this, for years I've been telling students that the death of a Supreme Court justice or an opening on the Supreme Court is kind, in Washington, D.C., inside the Beltway, it's kind of like preparing for a hurricane. You know, I don't know if people rush out and start buying bottled water and milk, you know, like for a major snowstorm or a hurricane when there's an opening on the Supreme Court. But let's put it this way. It's going to change everything in the Capitol as long as the seat is open. We're talking demonstrations. We're talking dominating conversations. So look at it this way. When you're looking especially at the death of Antonin Scalia, who is an incredibly symbolic figure over, let's say, the last third of a century in the post-Bork era, post-Roe v. Wade, which I guess is coming up with considerably more than a third of a century now. But anyway, you asked how big is the is an opening on the Supreme Court. Let me ask you, how big a news story was the Obergefell's decision on gay rights?
It was enormous, huge.
This is bigger. This is bigger because we currently have a 5-4 division in the Supreme Court on everything that Scalia himself said is connected to the court having assumed what he thought was incorrect, a super legislative role in American life. The way I put it is, you know, have put it is that for some time now, there has only been one person in the United States of America whose vote on anything counted, and that's Justice Kennedy, because he's the swing vote in a 5-4. So how important has every seat on the court been in an era where everything's decided, everything that matters, it seems, is decided on 5-4 votes? It's the single biggest thing in American politics when it comes to fundraising, campaigning, whatever. And if you thought you needed anything to make this year's race even crazier, this is it.
So let's talk about some advice that you would give to journalists as they prepare and undertake to cover Antonin Scalia's funeral.
Well, okay. I've got a post going up today at Get Religion that notes several things just of a strictly religious nature. First of which is the Washington, D.C. area is a particularly interesting area for Roman Catholics in terms of some tensions, kind of liturgical tensions and cultural tensions between the more conservative diocese of Arlington, Virginia, and then the Washington, D.C. diocese, which is led by a man who's very closely identified with Pope Francis. Meanwhile, Scalia's own son, Paul, is a priest in the more conservative diocese of Arlington. And Scalia himself was a bit of a liturgical traditionalist who, whenever possible, attended services that were in Latin. So Scalia represents kind of a very old-school Catholicism. If you want to put the Antonin Scalia family picture on your wall, it's going to be larger than a 5x7, or you won't be able to see anybody's face. This is a Catholic's Catholic from another era. When it comes to his personal life, his personal convictions, and his theology. So the fact that the service is going to be held at the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception, the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception, as opposed to that liberal, progressive, Episcopal cathedral on the hill, the National Cathedral, instead it's going to be held at in a building that's a symbol of a more conservative approach to Catholicism and to religious life, the Basilica, the Immaculate Conception, which is one of the largest churches in all of Christendom. It will be very interesting to see how full it is. It will be interesting to see who preaches, who is the celebrant at the altar. I've seen online speculation that his own son, Paul, may end up being the celebrant of the service. I think it will be interesting to see how many archbishops and cardinals from around the country attend and what role they play, if any, in the service. And it will be very interesting if the Mass as is in Latin. Would it take special permission from the Archbishop of Washington for the service, for example, to be celebrated with the priest facing to the east, instead of facing out toward the congregation? So from a liturgical perspective, it's going to be extremely interesting. From a political perspective, the whole world is abuzz right now, wanting to know whether or why President Barack Obama will not attend. If you wanted to have like an explosion in Twitter drudge land, the President of the United States plays golf during the Antonin Scalia funeral. That would be like culture wars, you know, on steroids.
Any other advice for the journalist who wants to poke their head in there? And what kind of questions should they be asking? What things should they be noticing? Details.
Well, yeah, in terms of political or religious?
A little bit. Let's start with the religious. What should they notice religiously about the thing?
Well, that, like I just said, the key is the service itself. Scalia also had very strong opinions. I've put a document up that I first saw through the website of Rodrir. He had very strong opinions on the role of sermons in funerals. And Scalia was extremely committed to the idea that at a funeral, you don't get up there and just say lots of nice things about the person. That the ancient Christian tradition is that funerals are not about the person who just died. A Christian funeral to the ancient church is about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And Scalia said that he thought the proper sermon in a funeral has almost nothing to do with the person who died, and instead becomes an almost Catholic version of an evangelical presentation of the reality of the resurrection and the life to come. It would be interesting to see if whoever preaches, if they pay any attention to that and give the man his own wish, which is a funeral that is not about him. Once again, on the political side, I think the action is going to be both outside and inside the building. I would not be at all surprised if there were protesters at the funeral on the outside. Security, I would imagine, will be rather intense. And like I said, it will be from an American Catholic perspective, it would be very hard to name a more controversial figure on one side or a more beloved figure on the other. And you probably have noticed in the coverage, he's also an interesting person in that Scalia has his liberal critics primarily who are activists, but among the legal community, he had very, very close friends on the left. The most famous, of course, being Justice Ginsburg, who his, I mean, these two couples, the justice and her husband, and Scalia and his wife, they've been celebrating New Year's together for, like, you know, decades. They were very close personal friends. And she has observed that even though they disagreed on almost everything, that she always rewrote her opinion on any case where they differed. She always rewrote her opinion, especially if she was writing for the majority, after Scalia had turned in his opinion, because she felt it always improved their statement of the law, even while they were dissenting with him. It would cut out the kind of what he would call claptrap arguments and would force the other side to focus their argument on something of substance. And, of course, which led to his most scathing opinions about the works of Justice Kennedy, specifically those on abortion and gay marriage. So, yeah, I'm afraid, look for demonstrators and very tight security.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. When we come back, we're going to talk some more about media coverage of Antonin Scalia and his funeral. When we come back, perhaps should one of the angles be one less Roman Catholic on the court? We'll get Terry's answer to that on the other side of the break.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Hey Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore, thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In my family, education means cultivating wisdom and virtue by teaching what is good, true, and beautiful. Memoria Press makes this type of education possible with their classical Christian curriculum. Characterized by simplicity, quality, and affordability, Memoria Press gives my children a rich classical education. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
O Lord, open my lips.
And my mouth will declare your praise.
Listen to chapel services live, weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
Defend us from all evil and bring us to everlasting life.
Amen.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of the death and the funeral of Justice Antonin Scalia. Terry, I'm wondering whether one of the angles ought to be, especially when it comes to the religion angle on this particular subject and this man, is simply one less Roman Catholic on the court.
Well, it's interesting. Scalia talked over and over about the fact that we live in a land ruled by nine highly unrepresentative people. I mean, he said this as a New Yorker and, of course, as a Harvard grad. But it would be interesting to see if, in this populist age we have, on the Republican side, if Republican candidates start pledging, okay, I promise you the next justice on the U.S. Supreme Court will be a black or Latino evangelical who didn't go to Harvard or Yale. Or I guarantee you the next justice on the court will speak Spanish and is going to come from the Sun Belt, you know, probably from, you know, from somewhere in Texas or something. If they made this a kind of rebellion against the East Coast establishment, there's a very famous quote from the late William F. Buckley, in which Buckley says that he, if offered a choice but of being, having his entire life ruled by the voting of the first 2,000 names listed in the Boston phone book, or the votes of the 2,000 members of the Harvard faculty, he said he would pick the phone book in terms of getting an actual diverse look at who America is. That it would be hard to pick a less diverse segment of our culture than the people who are found worthy of being nominated to the Supreme Court. We currently have all graduates of Harvard and Yale on the court, which is an unusual circumstance. Of course, we also have five Roman Catholics, or we had until Scalia's death, five Roman Catholics of every conceivable type of Catholicism or commitment or lack of commitment to Catholicism. So whenever there's an opening on the court, this issue of diversity on the court is always a huge issue. The fact that this is occurring during a presidential election and all of the hypocrisies that go on with that, I mean, you know, based on previous cases, that if a liberal justice died right now, if Ginsburg had died and George W. Bush was president, we already know what, I mean, from previous examples, what liberal Democratic senators would be saying, that it would be a completely unfair situation to fill that seat with the appointment of a Republican in the last part of his term, that he should wait until the next president is elected so that we have a more Democratic representative form of appointment process for the court. That's exactly what they would be saying because that's what they've said in the past. And since we have a liberal Democrat in the White House, and we have the Republicans controlling the House and Senate, and we're in an election year, thus we have Republicans saying exactly the same thing for exactly the same reasons. They don't think it's fair for a liberal Democrat to get to fill that conservative slot on the court. This is, they know how important the court is and how important the court has been ever since Roe v. Wade, and even more specifically, the hearings on Judge Bork, when the court literally swung in the balance, and Joseph Biden and several others created a new verb in the American political dictionary, which is to bork someone, which is, I mean, to turn the entire process into a personal battle over their personal characteristics and opinion as opposed to the quality of their legal career. And that's where we've lived. We've lived in the land of borking ever since that moment when it comes to the court. And Scalia hated that more than anyone who's ever lived, which makes it so ironic that his death now will create the apocalyptic war to end all wars over these very issues.
It, it kind of raises a question in my mind. I don't want to go too far afield with it, Terry, but it, I think I'd like your answer to it. He was the last of the Reagan appointees, and that was seems to me like centuries ago and in an entirely different country at the time. It almost seems a time that was quaint in its kind of moral reasoning and things like that. Could Antonin Scalia, if appointed by a conservative president in today's America, could he be confirmed?
Depends on who controls the Senate. It's that simple. When liberals are appointed and run past a Republican Congress, they're usually approved after long and specific processes, but they're still approved. When conservatives are appointed to the court and Democrats control the process, you often have people, you have it come down to brass tacks and people's names are withdrawn. So at this point with the Republicans, I mean, obviously this entire race now, it's no longer just about the White House. It's now also about control of the Senate, because this gives the Democrats in crucial states like Ohio and everything else, it gives them a whole other, you know, level of venom to go at, you know, to pour into the race. By the way, I do need to, I've been quietly looking up something here on my computer while we talked. Believe it or not, he's not the last of the Reagan appointees, because who appointed Justice Anthony Kennedy?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So there you go.
We'll say among the last, the Reagan.
Well, let's put it this way. Perhaps you can say the last Reagan appointee who turned out the way Reagan thought they would. Would be your other way of looking at that.
One last question for you, Terry, and that is back to kind of the journalist, and maybe this is more of a book than it is an article, or maybe a feature-length article for some newspaper or magazine. The life of Antonin Scalia, his public life, life of public service, as an example of religion in the public square, what do you think of the subject?
Well, it's certainly intriguing, because he's known more than anything else for his commitment to originism and to the belief that the whole point of the law is to care nothing about the legislative process whatsoever and to strictly rule on what you believe the creators of the document of the U.S. Constitution, Bill of Rights, etc., what they meant when they wrote it. And other than that, he believed in throwing things back to the American people at the level of legislation at state and national levels, and which leads to a famous case, you know, related to religious liberty, where to the horror of conservatives, he kept this same philosophy and believed that in an increasingly pluralistic America, that the state needed to have a bit more control over the free exercise of religion in America. And he wrote that famous opinion that he didn't think that it should be automatically legal for Native Americans to be able to use hallucinogenic drugs in the midst of traditional ceremonies. The decision that everybody, that the left now quotes against a conservative, strong view of free practice of religion. The case they cite and the opinion they cite was written by none other than Antonin Scalia. And he defended this. He defended his opinion on that case many, many times to conservative audiences as being consistent with his legal and political philosophy. Now, was that the same as his own personal philosophy in terms of religion? No, it wasn't. And you could speculate all you want, now that he's gone, what he would have done with the Obamacare decision coming down now, involving the Little Sisters of the Poor, you know, Christian colleges and universities, etc. But I guarantee you that if he had ended up casting a vote for the winning side, and now it looks like it's going to be a 4-4 deadlock, if Scalia had cast a vote for the winning side and had been asked to write the opinion, I guarantee you he would have based his opinion not on a pure and open stated case of free exercise of religion, but he would have said that this is what we see now in state by state. They're defending it. This should be the Little Sisters of the Poor should have the right to practice their faith the way they want to, because legislators have voted at the national level for the free exercise of religion and for the Religious Liberty Protection Act. He ironically would, consistent with his political beliefs, would throw it back to the legislature. Now, would he then go back to his chambers and cheer because he's in favor of traditional Catholics being able to live out their faith? Have no doubt about it. But that delicate balance between his personal beliefs and his very strict, rigorous legal philosophy, it would have been fascinating to watch in these decisions we now don't get to see him make. It would have been fascinating to watch for the exact same reason his whole career has been fascinating. This high wire act between his strong conservative religious convictions and this philosophy of his that the founders of this nation, imperfect though they may have been, we're going to have to live with their words or else all chaos results.
Terry Mattingly, a senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, and founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, thanks for being our guest.
Glad to be here.
This summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference is going to be a really good one. It includes Dr. Larry Rasch, Dr. Carl Fikencher, both of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And we also have some regulars, Chris Rosebro, Fighting for the Faith, and Jonathan Fisk of Worldview Everlasting. Joining us for the first time this summer is going to be Pastor Brian Wolfmiller and Adrian Dorr-Heinz. They're going to all be making the case in their various areas of expertise, and the conference is coming up June the 10th and the 11th. This summer in Collinsville, Illinois, that's just 15 miles east of St. Louis. The conference is $100. It includes three meals. And we have limited this conference, like last year, to 400 people. So you need to register now. You register by going to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. And there you'll see a picture of all the conference speakers and their topics. Click on that, and you can register right there and pay online. You can pay by check if you have any questions whatsoever. You can send Craig an email, craig@issuesetc.org, or you can also give us a call right here and ask for Craig. He'll answer any conference questions you might have. 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385. It's this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June the 10th and the 11th in Collinsville, Illinois. When we come back, Molly Ziegler-Hemingway of The Federalist will join us. We're going to talk about feminist outrage over recent motherhood statements by singer Adele.
Are you looking for a quality Christian high school education in the Lutheran tradition? My name is Dr. Jay Krause, principal of Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, inviting you to our open house on Sunday, February 21st, from 1 to 3 in the afternoon here at our Edwardsville campus. You can meet faculty and staff, administration, students and parents, and find out more about our dynamic ministry. For more information, contact us at 618-656-0043, or check out our new website at melhs.org.
How do John's famous words, "The Word became flesh," help us understand John's gospel? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February is the Concordia Commentary on John 1:1 through 7:1. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or check it out at issuesetc.org. This new commentary covers the first six chapters of John. The Concordia Commentary on John by Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Bill Weinrich.
The saints at Gethsemane Evangelical Lutheran Church in downtown Marion, Ohio, invite you to join us as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation, which He won for us in His perfect life, death, and resurrection. Sunday school for all ages begins at 9:15 a.m. with a divine service following at 10:30. Visit our website, Gethsemane-LCMS.org, or find us on Facebook to learn more about our confessional, historical, and liturgical congregation.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth, Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. The Lutheran Church of the Good Shepherd in Greenville, South Carolina, St. Paul Lutheran, Chatfield, Minnesota, St. John Lutheran, Napoleon, Ohio, First Lutheran, Lufkin, Texas, Concordia Lutheran, Sykeston, Missouri, Hope Lutheran, Granite City, Illinois, Trinity Lutheran, Gladson, Alabama, and Lord of Life Lutheran, Chesterfield, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.